You've got Nancy Rowe and Kim Brown. We are discussing the Liver Lineup updates and unfiltered insights, and we're covering AASLD 2025. We're talking now about metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease, or MASLD. The first thing that I wanted to emphasize is that the global mortality trend in MASLD is changing. I think that none of us are surprised to know that about a third of the world has metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease. But you really want to identify who with MASLD is going to get sick from their MASLD. Remember, most of our patients with fatty liver, for metabolic reasons, die of cardiovascular disease or non-liver related cancer. But some of those individuals are going to be at risk for cirrhosis, HCC, and death from liver related events. And this global mortality trend looked at a really large group of individuals globally over time and found that I was surprised that although MASLD is increasing in women, it's really men that are having a higher rate of mortality, and that this is both liver and non-liver related mortality, which was predominantly, as I already said, cardiovascular and non-liver related malignancy. But I struggle, and Kim, I'd be interested to know what you are, thinking, but how I take this and apply it to the patients that are both in my clinic, but actually not in my clinic that need to be here. And I know we're going to cover that a little bit, but how do we engage the individual at a time when we can offer a, an improvement in their disease to prevent this?
Yeah, it's, this has really become the entire focus, I think, of our discipline is fatty liver disease, MASLD, and morbidity, mortality related to it, right? So my opinion is we have to change it from the beginning, meaning diet and controlling the comorbidities that we are now treating with all the GLP-1s, right? So getting back to understanding how really a lot of this, again, our genetics haven't really changed, right? It has to be how we live. It has to be what we're exposed to. It has to be diet, et cetera. So I think we need to rethink as clinicians how we get back to the basics, which we have always left in the past in primary care clinics, right? But I think we all have to get involved, but not just as clinicians, but as a society, to try to change this trajectory, because it's happening all over the world.
Absolutely. And if we want to go to the next abstract, we can start to talk a little bit about how to change that trajectory. So this next abstract that I don't want to cover in too much depth, but it looked at awareness of MASLD in not just providers, but also patients. Well, let me flip that. Not just patients, but also providers. So it's not unusual for a person to not be aware of something if they don't know they're at risk. But it's really the concern when you're looking at providers who may not be aware of someone that is an appropriate referral or might have a therapy that would decrease the trajectory of their disease. So this study looked at the NHANES database. We all know that NHANES is a nice snapshot of certain sections of America. It can be enriched in a population that you want to look at more closely. And the NHANES database has had a couple of iterations where it was enriched in patients at risk for MASLD. They looked at this baseline as well as post-COVID, imagining that COVID might have done something, the pandemic, that led to less healthy behaviors or maybe even more awareness. Certainly, I think we recognize that alcohol, kind of changed during the pandemic. But they found that in this group and NHANES, although there were a certain, a significant number that had at-risk metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease or MASH that might be appropriate for pharmacologic therapy, only one in five patients that were at risk were actually aware of their disease. And that this was probably partially just related to providers too, not recognizing a patient that's at risk and linking them to appropriate management.
Yeah, this is sad. It's just sad, right? It's devastating to have a patient referred to you with advanced liver disease, cancer, liver failure, needing a transplant, where they never knew, right? And they say all the time, my doctor never told me I had liver disease until I had a variceal bleed, or I developed ascites or something like that. So the under-recognition of liver disease in general is just, it's a crisis now, in large part because we have so many patients presenting with risk. So I think that this data is totally in line with what I see in my own clinic.
Yeah, and to build on that, Kim, if you look at the bottom aspect of this chart, and NHANES, some of the NHANES trials did actually have FibroScan, but some of them might have been using a score like FIB-4. But FIB-4 is not a great tool for early disease, but it's a pretty good tool for a person with advanced disease. And pre-pandemic, over 90% of individuals with clearly advanced disease were unrecognized. So this is someone who has cirrhosis, and you do not recognize that they have cirrhosis. And although it did seem to improve late pandemic to about 80%, that's still a lot of patients with really bad disease that are being missed.
Yeah, no, I agree. We need much better screening tools for that are automatic, right? We see how bad we are with CNV with recommendations. We're woefully worse with MASLD.
Yes. Well, this also builds on this. I sound like I'm just, doom and gloom here. But this next clinical study was a very interesting snapshot of what I see every day. And this looked at referral patterns for MASLD in clinical practice, using things like FIB-4 and breaking it down by individuals that were at low risk, intermediate risk, or high risk by their FIB-4, as well as their practice setting, such as primary care, GI, subspecialty. This found that referral rates are low, but they're about the same regardless of your FIB-4. So all of our algorithms that say you should hold on to patients that are at low risk and refer patients that are at intermediate or high risk, or take that intermediate risk and apply a second tool and then refer, those aren't working. And that makes sense to me. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me like, oh, that's a successful statement. But it makes sense that if I thought enough about my patients, I applied a FIB-4, and I don't know how to interpret it, and I had 5 minutes to talk to my patient who really was mostly concerned about, depression or their anxiety or insomnia, I might just refer this patient to someone who's going to make sure my patient's healthy. And we see this in clinic, right? I get patients who have low-risk fatty liver disease. Sometimes they're, 80, and I'm like, really? This is what we wanted to talk about today? Well, you're doing great. You're doing great. But it also kind of reflects the fact that we need better tools, better automated systems to identify patients to go through a care pathway for fatty liver disease, and not rely on something like a FIB-4 and the current algorithms that we have. And, most of the referrals do come from primary care, but primary care really didn't do a lot better than OBGYN or the other places where our patients are. We shouldn't look at this as a failing grade, as rather a place for opportunity.
Yeah, I think we need to completely rethink our strategy. I hearken back to how we eliminated hepatitis C in our dialysis population. If you ask a primary care clinician to do, and it's automatic, you have to actually do .FIB-4. Yeah, that they do have to take an action to do that, and then tell them what to do based on that, because that is what our current algorithm suggests, is that primary care try to identify patients through FIB-4. They don't do it. It's just one more thing that they have to think about in their clinic. And if a system owns a patient population, if they're responsible for a patient population, why can't this be done automatically and the referral taken automatically, out of that whole sequence of events process? We have tried to implement with our primary care clinicians, then this is just for elevated liver tests. We don't even ask them to do a FIB-4. We say, if you have elevated liver tests, just order the FibroScan. Here's the order. Just order it. And if it is F2 or above, send them to us. And they don't want to do that. They don't want to take that action. It's just one more step in a multitude of things they have to do. So we have to think of different strategies, how to identify these patients and get them into care.
Yeah, and I think also going back to Hep C, opt-out testing is a lot more successful than opt-in. So, you know, if you have a patient who is getting labs and, you know, the EMR says that they've never been screened for Hep C, and there's like something that says, click here if you don't want to order a Hep C test, and the Hep C test is usually ordered. If it says, click here if you want Hep C to be done, no one really clicks there. And so that's another lost opportunity for screening. And I think we're going to have to build things in, you know, where, you know, your patient's been flagged for at-risk mast cell. Click here if you don't want to refer to hepatology or you don't want a fiber scan. And then we might have more patients move across that care cascade.
Yeah, I think we have to rethink how we deliver care. It's always been in the hands of the primary care clinician to identify and refer. But this is really population management, right? How we deliver medicine is changing, has changed, and should change. How we are more active in terms of identifying patients rather than hoping for the best.
Absolutely. So the next couple of things I wanted to talk about are together, and that's when we recognize that mast cell patients do better if they do not have another reason for liver disease, whether that's Hep B or Hep C or alcohol. The first kind of makes sense. The first was a study that just looked at the patient's reluctance to discuss alcohol use and using PEth at a cutoff of 25, which is not a very heavy drinker, but someone who's drinking, and to see if PEth scores correlated with the amount of alcohol that was captured in discussion in the clinic. And as we can all imagine, both men and women were underrepresenting the amount of alcohol that they were drinking based on a biochemical measure that's a pretty strong measure that's linked to alcohol use. And so some patients that said that they didn't drink at all, you know, up to half of them actually had some evidence of some alcohol use. And, you know, I think this is just a reminder that we either need to destigmatize this conversation so patients feel comfortable talking to us about what they're actually doing, or more utilization of a diagnostic study that helps us have a better conversation with the patient in front of us. And I don't know about you, Kim, but I tend to use PEth testing in patients who I know have alcohol use disorder, but I always tell them that I'm testing them. And often I say, hey, listen, I'm going to order this. Not because I don't believe you, but we're going to start to build a conversation about how you're really invested in your health. And sometimes the patients are like, oh, can we not test me today? Or I'm sorry, I had a slip. And some patients are like, yeah, I want to be tested. I want to see that score. I also test people who say that they don't drink at all, whose disease seems to not be responding or seems to be progressing despite you know, what you expect. So if I have a patient who might be on a GLP-1 or I'm given resmetirizumab for their fatty liver disease and, you know, their numbers aren't getting better or their fibrosis scores are not improving, I might do a PEth, but I always tell the patient. I never just spring it on them. I think that that's not going to lead to open discussion.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I think we take a different tactic. We use it as a blood test. I don't tell people I'm going to measure their serum sodium, right? We have a conversation about alcohol at every visit. I think this has implications in two ways. One, our clinical trials have clearly included patients who have both metabolic disease and alcohol use disorder, right? Because again, we know that patient reporting is not accurate in many ways, not just because maybe patients are reluctant, but also people really don't understand how much alcohol they're actually consuming. So the accuracy is actually not very good. But the second way is it allows me in a patient, regardless of what they tell me, it gives me an opportunity to show them the data and say, whatever you think you're drinking, right? This amount is probably harmful, right? It's, you know, in a non-judgmental way, but to talk about the effects of alcohol and to use the test to try to help them understand that they are likely drinking more than they maybe think they're drinking or reporting that they're drinking. So I don't routinely tell patients I'm going to do this. But I do use it as a tool to have an open conversation about the effects of alcohol on their liver.
Yeah, I might not have been as forthcoming to, you know, originally, but now that everyone's blood tests are open to them, you know, seeing them in the EMR often before I've seen them. And I've had some patients who just have gotten very angry about having an alcohol test, which is why I tell them I'm getting it so that they can still be angry with me, but at least they're proactively angry and not, you know, when they're looking at their labs. But if we look at the next study, it really emphasizes why, as you said, Kim, you have to have that conversation about alcohol. You have to do that CAGE questionnaire or your audit score. You have to have this because this was a study out of India looking at a large group of individuals that had metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease, demonstrating that even modest amounts of alcohol. So what you and I would have agreed that the CDC says is lower risk drinking. And I tell my patients that there is no amount of alcohol that is no risk. There is always risk. It's just that the CDC will help you define what is lower risk for you. But even modest amounts of alcohol increase the risk of fibrosis, and that's compounded by metabolic risk factors. So the more metabolic risk factors you have, the more progressive your disease. And if you add alcohol to that, then they are absolutely going to have a worse outcome than someone who does not add alcohol. And that is, you know, certainly lots of alcohol is more dangerous than less alcohol, but no alcohol is clearly safer than less.
You know, when I saw this data, first of all, this is great data and I believe it. But I think back to our days with hepatitis C. And if you recall, one of our colleagues talking about the pancakes, right? If he's had one pancake or two.
Eric Wallace and his pancakes.
Three pancakes. And I think the same thing is true here. You know, hypertension, diabetes, hyperlipidemia, obesity, sleep apnea, and alcohol. It's just another pancake on that stack, right? So, I believe this data. It's important data for us to help patients understand that, in my opinion, I don't know about your opinion, in my opinion, if I have MASLD, no amount of alcohol is safe.
No, I agree. Now, if you're 90, you are allowed to do whatever you want. But
if you're 90 and still alive, go for it.
But I think that this is especially important in our younger population because when you're 30 and you have MASLD, I have to keep you alive a long time. Yeah. And, you know, I might not be able to prevent your becoming diabetic, but we can at least work on a preventable, you know, reason that you're going to make your disease more severe.
Yeah.
All right. The next study is therapeutic. So I'm going to just turn very briefly into semaglutide. So we all recognize that semaglutide, I think, was approved for at-risk fatty liver disease in October. And most of us thought that this was because of weight loss. So, you know, when you are taking a GLP-1, we didn't necessarily, although it does decrease steatosis, it doesn't, you know, I think a lot of us felt that it was the reduction in weight, the reduction in steatosis, and not the drug itself that led to improvements in MASLD. And this study really suggested that there was improvements in liver-related events independent of weight loss, which I think is really exciting. It means that now if I have a patient who's had marginal weight reduction but is otherwise tolerating their GLP-1, I'm going to use those non-invasive tools to decide the success of my agent and not weight. And I think when we're looking at combination therapy, many of our patients with MASLD are going to end up on multiple drugs that are liver beneficial. And you could argue that could include their statin or the ACE inhibitor, all kinds of things. You want to stop things that are not beneficial, but you might not stop their GLP-1 even if they're not getting to the weight that you would hope that they would achieve.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, this was interesting data, very similar to what you saw with resmetirom, some people in that study were on a GLP. It was stable. Some people in that study did lose weight, but the overall effects of the drug was independent of those two things. So, and we've known this for exercise. I tell patients that exercise independent of weight reduction also improves liver-related steatosis. So I agree with you. I think it is important that we recognize that many of these medications work independent of weight reduction, even though a lot of the things we tell patients to do result in weight reduction. But I agree with you. I think it is important that we understand the benefits outside of weight reduction.
Yeah. Now, just like exercise, if you exercise and you lose weight, you probably have more benefit than if you exercise but do not lose weight. Yes. So the semaglutide did have more impact if it also came with more weight reduction. Yeah. So that as we look at the next generations of GLP-1s, knowing that some of these are so much more impactful on weight reduction, those might have more impact on liver-related outcomes. But do not abandon the drug just because your patient is not becoming the supermodel that they thought they were going to become on their GLP-1.
Well, and I also think encouraging for patients, because some of my patients don't lose weight on GLP-1s, right? But I think important data to help them understand there may be benefits outside that.
Yeah, and I think lots of times your patient wants to lose weight and they get frustrated because they're not losing weight. But if you can tell them the reason you started the drug is to make their liver healthier, to decrease liver-related outcomes, and that is still happening, then maybe they are going to be a little more tolerant of the agent, knowing that the outcome is not just weight reduction. And it's really important, GLP-1 long-term use is not great, right? These are really good agents, but patients do stop them. And, when we're looking at ways to keep a patient on something that's going to offer benefit, knowing what your measurable is also really important. So there's a new class of drugs coming, and this is your FGF21. These are not quite prime time yet, but they're getting closer. And I think a lot of the data has suggested that they have more antifibrotic effects than some of the other drugs that are current tools for us. So there are several, but I picked this study looking at efexofermin and use in patients with portal hypertension and cirrhosis, demonstrating that long-term use of efexofermin did improve portal hypertension in a very measurable way, which I think is really exciting, because when you're looking at our current drugs that are available, they are not approved for use in cirrhosis. And we don't know yet if a GLP-1 or if a thyroid beta agonist is able to take someone with more advanced disease and lead to regression to that place where they're going to have less, liver-related outcomes if they were further down on their disease path. And this class of drugs seems like it is going to be an opportunity for some of the patients that, are teetering towards transplant, and you want to really bring them onto the other side. This might be an option for them.
Yeah, I found this. This is very exciting, I think, for us in the field of liver disease to see potential benefit for our patients with the most advanced disease, right? Your goal in anybody with cirrhosis obviously would be to have regression of fibrosis, but this is important data to look at improvement in portal hypertension. So really taking the patient who is, if you define portal hypertension as decompensation, sort of getting them back, recompensating them. And I think this is great data. It's very exciting.
So also really important is there was data suggesting that patients with MASH or MASLD may not be able to follow the same, expectations as other diseases. And we can talk about why that might be. But this trial looked at patients who have MASH cirrhosis and were started on carbetolol or a non-selective beta blocker to prevent variceal bleeding. And the carbetolol was less effective in patients with MASH compared to other diseases. And the variceal bleeding occurrence was higher. I'm not sure that I see that in my own population, but it's maybe because varicose bleeding is so scary that I am frightened and I haven't really thought about why they're having that varicose bleed, but rather how to control the varicose bleeding. But I think that using, you know, the rule of fives or the Baveno, you know, assessment to identify at-risk individuals and then to start those individuals that are at risk on a non-selective beta blocker to decrease that risk might not have the same performance in maybe American patients with fatty liver disease as other etiologies. What do you think, Kim?
You know, I found this to be interesting data. I always try to think about what the mechanism is behind it. And, you know, they're comparing the MASH patient to the patient with viral hepatitis. And we recognize that steatosis drives portal hypertension, as does inflammation, right? I would be interested to know, in their patients with viral hepatitis, were these patients controlled? My assumption is their B was treated, their C was treated. So their risk of progressive fibrosis was much less than somebody with MASLD, where if you're not treating the steatosis, you're driving portal hypertension as well. So whether you're getting the same effect in terms of portal pressure reduction in a patient population who has controlled underlying disease versus uncontrolled underlying disease. So anyway, that was my thought when I looked at this, but I don't know.
Well, it does make sense that if you have a patient who's got MASLD, they are going to have progressive disease unless you're treating them. And these are patients that had decompensated cirrhosis, which is clearly not an indication for any of our approved agents for MASLD. But you can certainly treat a person with decompensated cirrhosis with Sofel or with a nucleotide or a nucleoside. And you know, unlike how we would normally identify a patient at risk for portal hypertension using our Baveno guidelines, you know, combination of your platelets and your FibroScan or your elastography scores, these are individuals that I think had endoscopy and were identified as having varices. That's a very different population. Now, we can talk about Baveno. I'm constantly reminding my trainees that FibroScan or elastography is less reliable in your patients that have a BMI that's elevated. And so using a score to make pretty significant decisions about management that may have less reliability is a challenge. But this is not that population. These are individuals who had endoscopy. And I would think that what you said is correct, that if you have controlled disease, unless you were also drinking on top of your cured hepatitis C, you are at less risk to progress than someone who's got metabolic reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. Or I, you know, it is interesting data, you know, that it just kind of goes along with this group of patients having higher risk of cancer, higher risk of, you know, potential complications. And I, in my mind, I think a lot of it has to do with the underlying disease and the fact that we haven't, with viral hepatitis, we've controlled the disease, right? And we have data that when you control replication, you somewhat control the trajectory, right, of progression. And with MASLD or MASH, my guess is these are not patients where you're controlling their underlying disease. These are patients that, you know, likely have progressive disease. You probably, in my opinion, will see the same thing with alcohol, right? Right. Even though that wasn't the group of patients they looked at. But
well, thank you so much, Kim. This has been a wonderful conversation. I encourage everyone to look at the other podcast and to look forward to EASL 2026, which should be our next big conference summary. And as a reminder, you have been listening to Kim Brown and Nancy Rowe in the Liver Lineup, Updates and Unfiltered Insights.